one other influence was there was a dairy microbiologist named Hammer, who was, he seemed old to me, but he probably wasn't so old. But I was always impressed with this guy because he worked in the lab. Most professors didn't work in the lab, and I always thought, oh, dang it, I'm going to see to it that I stick in the lab. And I admired Hammer for that. So when I got here, in spite of the fact that I was chairman, I always tried to keep my hand in to a certain extent. And then we had sabbatical leaves, and I always took my sabbatical leave. I said, to heck with it. So I'd take a year off and spend, and I didn't monkey around. I worked in the lab hard when I was on it, and so on. So it was a sort of rejuvenation, and it served a heck of a nice purpose because I could say, okay, I'm going on sabbatical. Don't assign me on any committees because I'm going to be gone. And then I could get off of committees the year I was gone, and it always took about 4 or 5 years before they caught up with you again. So you you had a kind of a break on that basis. And then I was very upset with the with sort of the administration here. When I came here, there was only one office on this whole floor. Well, we were only half the floor at that time. No offices for anybody else. And I said, yeah, what the heck's going on here anyway? We got associate professors, and but they looked at it. There's only one professor in this department. Well, I remember I went over to see the dean, and I said, I've got this fellow, Mert Otter, who's with us, who's a first-class guy, and I want to advance him to professor. And he said, professor of what? I said, well, professor of biochemistry. He says, you're the professor of biochemistry. We have to give him a different title. Well, I said, that's funny. A lot of schools I've been, they got five professors in there, and they're professors of chemistry. I said, you look across the street, there's a professors of chemistry over there, and so on. Well, I finally got it through that they made him a professor. And then that gradually went on here in the school. There were more than one professor. He wanted to make him a professor of biochemical research. I said, wait a minute. He can be professor of chemistry. I'm going to have biochemistry. I'm going to be biochemistry. And then when I got, I was 19 years, I was head. And I guess I was 62 or something like that. And at 65, you were supposed to retire as chairman. And they had a kind of a funny philosophy that you should let your department go way downhill so that the new guy could come in and appoint his own people of interest, you see. And I wasn't about to do that. I didn't want to see our department go to hell. It was rating right up in the first 10 and so on in the country. Why should I tell these guys now, you got to get out of here? And so I said, no, I'm resigning as head. Jesus, they had a fit. They just had a fit. And the fact of the matter is, I had to say, okay, I'm leaving. And I went out, and I had a good offer at Michigan State University for a position. And I was going, but they finally came around to it then, and they made Mert Otter chairman of the department, and he was chairman for about 10 years or a little more. And so on. And then Dick Hansen has come, and he's a very good chairman. So we've been lucky in a way. We've had good people in there, and they've been good to me. They haven't tried to kick me out or anything.
That comment, I think I read also that when you came here, you were someone has said you were able to actually build, to bring a lot of new people in. Was that still part of that old philosophy of?
Well, you see, when I came here, they had a professor, Victor Myers, who had been chairman of biochemistry here. I don't know for sure, but I think he got Alzheimer's disease or something, because he was going in and telling about all the lectures about his cars that he had bought and reminiscing about the professors he had met and so on. But it wasn't teaching much biochemistry, and it fell to the younger people to take care of this. And so essentially what they did was they made him the professor of clinical biochemistry, and he taught the pharmacy students and nurses, and we taught dental students and medical students and, of course, graduate and so on. So we had a clean sweep. He took everybody with him. So we had to appoint all new faculty. So I appointed a bunch of, you know, younger guys and so on. And of course, that made it congenial, as far as we didn't have to worry about hurting somebody else's feelings and so on. So in a sense, it was almost a new department at that time. And Victor Myers died in about 2 or 3 years, and then we had to take over teaching and nursing, and the pharmacy school disappeared, so that didn't have to be taught. And he had, Skeggs, you probably don't know Skeggs, but Skeggs was in his department, and he came and joined our department, and he's a first-class guy, and did a lot of work on hypertension and stuff like that. So and he's one that he more or less devised these automatic where you take a drop of blood and you just run it through, and they do the urea nitrogens and so on and so on. Well, he worked on the membranes and dialysis, kidney dialysis, but then he got to thinking about, okay, if we run this through, this blood through a membrane-like tube, and we can take off samples on the outside, and each one will be analyzed for a different thing. He made a fortune from that.
I'm going back a little bit again. You had that 1 year postdoc at Wisconsin. When you applied for the NRC, was that directed towards Wisconsin, or could you make your choice when you got the NRC fellowship?
No, I wrote out a research plan, and I'm amazed that I even got it, because if I think back, I wrote down every goddamn thing you could possibly do in 10 years or so on. But the fact of the matter is that when I got to Wisconsin, we didn't work on anything that I wrote. See, Wisconsin was noted at that time for nutritional studies and things like that, and they were working on growth factors, and that's where Woolley was when he discovered nicotinic acid, these kind of things. And Ed Tatum, of course, was there, and he had his PhD, but he couldn't get a job, and so he was there biding his time trying to get a job. And Ed and I then worked together on nutritional requirements of bacteria. We were the first actually to show that vitamin B1 is required for growth by bacteria. It was an interesting thing because we would take, and I don't know why, we take corn, soak it, grind it up, and then spin it, and then evaporate it down and fractionate it and so on. And that's how we found the B1 requirement and so on, because you could buy B1 and substitute it and so on. Well, we had this one fraction. You could evaporate it in the beaker, and you couldn't see a damn thing there. But you put some water in there and add it to the media, to this synthetic media, and with B1 and so on, damn bacteria would grow. Wouldn't grow without it. And so Ed then got interested in microchemistry. And he went over with Kegel in Holland. And Kegel was the guy that was working on biotin, actually, and so on. And what we had was biotin. Biotin is required in such small amounts that you just couldn't even see it. And so then he got hooked up, anyway, they got on to the genetics deal.
Beagle
and Tatum, yeah. And you see, it was a very fortunate setup because Tatum knew all about growth factors and this kind of thing. So then they would take and make these mutants and see which ones wouldn't grow if you left out this or left out that. And that's how they got together, and it was a very fortunate team because of this. Beagle, I'm sure, wouldn't have done it either if they hadn't had this setup.
How did you strike up this collaboration with Tatum on this project?
I don't know. He was there, and he was a nice guy. It was interesting working with him, though. He just hated, he would never wash dishes and so on. So we sort of struck up a deal. We'd run the experiment. Then he'd go and sit down and write the stuff up, and I'd be washing the dishes and getting things cleaned up. Poor guy smoked too much. He died of lung cancer. I don't know, his fingers were always brown from smoking. But they had a very good department of microbiology at that place, and actually we went down to they called it physiological chemistry, but it was more or less biochemistry, and I was more or less guided by Peterson, who was a professor of physiological chemistry. And so it was, again, it was sort of a metabolism, what do vitamins do, and stuff like that at that time. And of course, the finding that vitamins were part of enzymes, coenzymes, was a very exciting business at that time. Just as exciting as some of the things we have now. They seem commonplace at the present, but nobody knew why these things that were so required in such small amounts were actually, how could they do it? Well, of course, B1 is a part of a coenzyme, and nicotinic acid and niacin is part of a coenzyme, and flavins and all of this stuff got worked out at that particular time. I was sort of disappointed because I couldn't, I had 2-year fellowship, and workman offered me this job, but he wouldn't wait for a year, and I was going to go over and work with in Germany and at Heidelberg and so on, which I think he made a hell of a mistake, because I would have learned a lot about enzymology and so on and brought that back to them, and but he just wouldn't let me go, and I didn't dare turn the job down because jobs were too, at that time, too hard to get.
What, that was 37, wasn't it? Something like that.
Yeah. You didn't dare turn it down.
Had you anticipated going back to the Iowa State when you were up at Wisconsin, or had?
Oh, I can't. Yeah, I guess I wasn't surprised because workmen knew that we were being very productive at that time, and so on. So I don't remember whether he talked to me about that or not beforehand. I wouldn't be surprised if he did, though. But I was hoping he'd let me put it off a year.
He seems to have been a very controlling kind of individual in some respects.
Yeah, he was.
Not letting you go to Berkeley, not...
it was...
Not letting you go to Heidelberg.
Yeah, and he was his enemy, his worst enemy in a way, because, you see, we had a plant there that nowhere in the world. We had made the mass spectrometer. We'd made the thermal diffusion column. We could concentrate our own C13. There was no one else except it in the Columbia. They had, because of Urey's influence, they had the cyanide concentration of C13. But these guys were not. They were more physiological chemists in a way. They didn't know much about enzymes. They didn't know much about intermediate metabolism at that time. And so Workman really had a tremendous opportunity there. And you see, when he kicked me out, I was pretty much the guy that was responsible for putting up this thermal diffusion column. When you think back, it's a tremendous undertaking to build a 5-story thermal diffusion column that has to be gas tight and everything else. And if Krampitz was there, Krampitz has became head of microbiology here, and a good man, but I don't know, somehow they didn't have the same drive as we had at that time, and gradually that place just went backwards. And I told Workman, I told him, I said, you're just dumb as hell. All you have to do is sit on your can and let us guys work, you'll get the Nobel Prize just as sure as hell. And he would have. I know this for a fact. But he let it go. You see, a guy came over to see me once in Ehrensvard. And Ehrensvard was close to the Nobel Committee. I didn't know that at the time. We'd been drinking quite a lot, and somehow or other this came up. And I said, well, I'll never take that Nobel Prize with Workman. I was pissed off at him at that time. He kind of went back like this, you know, and whether this really had an impact, I don't know. His wife, Workman's wife, when I went back to Well, he died, and they had a sort of an honorary ceremony, and a bunch of us went back. She said, you just kept him from getting the Nobel Prize. I don't know. But he sure as hell would have got it, I'm almost certain. You know, that was a pretty outstanding thing at that particular time. Doesn't seem like much now, but then it was. And the fact of the matter is, it had a big impact on Calvin and those guys, because it was the first real kind of chemical proof of how CO2 could go into something and add on to another one. At that time, they were talking about CO2 going to formaldehyde and formaldehyde condensing and so on. But the addition of CO2 onto another organic compound, and then, of course, Calvin threw in the recycling and so on, and that's how they got it. But it is essentially what we had shown in bacteria, only a little different reaction. In fact, the matter is, for a long time, they used our reaction as their schemes for photosynthesis. They built cycles and so on. Well, they were wrong about oxaloacetate being there, but the principle was there. And this opened up a lot of new thinking about how autotrophic growth could occur.
Well, that's another thing. Wasn't Workman against working with animals?
Oh, yeah, that was a silly thing. We really got screwed there. You see, I kept telling Workman, we'll never get credit for real credit for this, and especially in those days. Today it would be recognized a lot more, but in those days there was a pretty clean separation. And I said, we got to show this in animals. I said, I'm sure that they fix CO2. We just got to show it. And he wouldn't let me do it. He said, that belongs in the zoology department. Well, then a publication came out. Krebs and Earl Evans. Earl Evans became chairman of the department of the University of Chicago. In fact, he's the guy that offered me a job before.
Really? Where,
yeah, one of the guys. They did. Krebs had done all his work with pigeon breast muscle. And the reason they use pigeon breast muscle is because they fly and they got a lot of oxidative capacity and so on. So they run a good Krebs cycle. But they don't they don't fix CO2. Muscle doesn't have the CO2 fixing enzymes in it. And so whenever he wanted to run the Krebs cycle, he had to add a C4 acid that would, now we know, would be made from pyruvate plus CO2 makes oxaloacetate. So this cycle can go. And he showed that if you put in malonate inhibits succinic dehydrogenase, which means that when you go around the cycle, when it gets to succinic, it can't make fumarate and it can't recycle. So the stuff piles up. So you have to add C4 acids in the presence of malonate to make this pyruvate get oxidized. Well, doggone it, they published a paper in Biochem Journal, in liver, and this guy went over to work on liver instead of pigeon breast muscle. And in liver, you didn't have to add the C4 acids. This thing would go without it. And it would pile up. In the presence of malonate, it would pile up the alpha-ketoglutarate and succinate and stuff like that. God, I said, and they never mentioned anything about CO2 fixation. And I said, Jesus, this is as plain as a nose on your face. They can make their own C4 acids from pyruvate, and they're taking CO2 and they're making it. So I went up to see Workman, and I told him, I said, this is just so damn obvious. You gotta let me do this. So he finally said, okay. Well, we made a very bad mistake. It was too bad, or we'd have been the first ones to show CO2 is used by animals. You see, I knew how to purify succinate and so on. And if you look at the scheme, if citric acid is symmetrical, which we thought, then this CO2 that would be fixed, and you'd have to go through the scheme to see it all, would be in the carboxyls of succinate. It would be formed from alpha-ketoglutarate, and the alpha-ketoglutarate, if it came from citrate, the way this scheme is, would have the CO2 in both the carboxyls. So I thought, okay, you throw in 2,4-dinitrophenylhydrazine, and that keto acid will precipitate. You purify that. And this is where I made a silly mistake, too. I'll oxidize this, and I'll get the succinic acid. And I know how to get that real pure. And you had to have pure stuff. But because I oxidized it, and this 2,4-dinitrophenylhydrazine has 6 carbons in it, and so on, I thought, well, the C13 would be too dilute. Just throw that away. So I threw it away. Gosh darn it, there wasn't anything in the succinate. And I was just flabbergasted. I was so disappointed. And then in about 3 or 4 months, out came a letter to the editor in JBC, where they isolated the alpha-ketoglutarate with C11, because then they can count it. Doesn't make any difference. And heck, the isotope was there. And I thought, what the hell's going on? How could I miss it? And so then I got busy and I synthesized. See, we didn't have alpha-ketoglutarate as a commercial compound. So you couldn't work with it. So I had to make my own. So I went to Beilstein and I looked up and I found out how to make alpha-ketoglutarate. And I made alpha-ketoglutarate, and then I found out how to separate it and purify it and so on. And sure enough, the alpha-ketoglutarate had it in, but it only had it in one carboxyl, not in two. Well, this made it seem that there wasn't citric acid, because we assumed citric acid was a symmetrical molecule, and if an enzyme acted on it, it couldn't tell the difference between the two carboxyls. Well, it's got 3, but the 2 that you... And I went over to Gilman and talked to him about this, and I said, can this be an intermediate in this Krebs cycle? No way. And so we all concluded that citric acid wasn't on it. That it either had to be a phosphorylated citric acid, or it had to be something so that these things were differentiated. Well, then I guess about 10 years that this held up, until Ogston came along, just a theoretical guy, and said enzymes are asymmetric. They can tell the difference between an asymmetric molecule. And of course it turned out that citric acid was on there. But if I had just taken that CO2 and counted it, even I think I would have seen a smidgen of C13 there, even though it was 6 times diluted, and might have worked it out. But I was so convinced of this symmetrical molecule business that I figured, no use, get the succinic acid, get it pure, and then it'll, if it's only in one carbon, it'll be diluted by 4, whereas the other way it would have been diluted 12 times and so on. So then, we worked that out, and Evans did too at the same time. And, we did a lot of nice work with Neer on these kind of things. Then when I went up to Minnesota, that was kind of interesting too, because...
But your association with Neer started before you went to Minnesota.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was awful good to us, you know. He, well, in any collaborative work like that, you're always delayed because you send stuff up and it takes a while and so on. And I remember I went to him and I said, well, Al, couldn't we make a mass spectrometer and down at Ames and so on? And, oh, sure you can. No problem, he said. We had a lot of problems, but